People came in, gave their speech, and then walked out. No clapping, not even a boo. Just complete silence. It shows the self-discipline that these miners had and the outrageous contempt they had for these plutocrats from the American Federation of Labor. At their conventions, all the leading socialists of those days addressed the convention. I don't mean Berger, I mean real socialists. Debs and Father Haggerty. This Father Haggerty was a renegade Catholic priest who threw in with the workers and was an extremely popular man among the Western Federation of Miners and the workers in general throughout the West. He was editor of the paper for the Western Federation of Miners. And when they, at the founding convention of the Socialist Party in 1901, Bill Haywood and Ed Boyce joined together. At the same time, Ed Boyce resigned as president because his brother and his father and his wife's brother and father had made a big strike, and Boyce resigned as president of the union and opened a hotel in Portland, Oregon. And a man named Moyer was elected president. At this same time, 1901, we first hear of a man who was afterwards to shape the whole policy of the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, which was the first expression of syndicalism in this country. 1901, we hear about the big strike in Telluride, Colorado, led by a man named Vincent St. John. And from now on, it seems that in every strike that Vincent St. John is the organizer of, there is violence. Not only against the workers, but violence against the capitalists. Jim Cannon, the founder of our movement, and a former IWW in his youth, says that this man, Vincent St. John, was the greatest organizer that he ever met in his political as well as his trade union life. The man was not a writer, he wasn't a speaker, but he imbued such confidence in the men that came in contact with him that these men developed afterwards into great organizers themselves. He had a second sense in sizing up individuals and knowing the particular role they could play in the movement. He had a great knack of explaining things to individuals that wanted to devote themselves to full-time work for the building of the IWW, and then throwing them out on their own to see if they could swim. He was a great patron of the noble art of the shortcut. Now, Jim never gave any explanation of what he meant by the shortcut, but as I said, in all these great strikes led by St. John, it seemed that a mine manager or a mine owner ended up with a hole in his head. He wasn't much on dickering and dallying and so forth about contracts and all this rigmarole. Now, the Telluride mine, city is in the mountains of southwest Colorado. With a big gold and silver center. The men used to work 11 hours a day, 13 days of the week, 15 days in a row, and then they got off the 14th. But they worked a 24-hour shift in order to get off the 14th day. The 8-hour law had been passed in Colorado, particularly under the agitation of the miners. And when the law was passed, the governor publicly said he wouldn't enforce it. It's unconstitutional. He was a whore, political whore, for the mine owners. Then the miners conducted a referendum. And the referendum was overwhelmingly in favor of the 8-hour day. Some were like 50,000 in favor, 46,000 to be exact. Still the governor said, no, nothing doing. I'm for upholding the Constitution. Well, that resulted in a terrific upheaval in Colorado that went on for almost 3 years. And St. John played probably the vital role in this period. One of his cuts was there was no notice when there was going to be a strike. You just got the boys together and said, well, I guess we quit at 5 o'clock tonight, huh? That's it. Of course, the mine owners raised the devil about this, not fair, you know, and so forth and so on. Bill Haywood also was adapted to taking a few shortcuts and in fighting for the 8-hour day in Colorado. Haywood was responsible for shutting down the smelters in Denver that were owned by the Guggenheimers. And the way they shut them down was as follows. They had a big union meeting. Bill Haywood had posted guards at the doors. That is, like what he called them, sergeant at arms. Wardens, miners used to call them. He appointed wardens at the door. And they discussed the situation. And they voted to strike. But nobody could leave the hall. These wardens were at the door so that nobody could go out of the union meeting and run to the boss and tell him, hey, the boys are going to go on strike tonight. It was agreed they're going to close down the mill at 12 o'clock that very night, the copper smelters. Well, you know, you close down a steel mill or any kind of a smelting operation, the furnaces will freeze. Unless they're drawn off, the metal is drawn off of them. Well, Haywood had the place closed up until 12 o'clock. Then runners were sent to the different mills telling the boys that were coming off the shift at 12 o'clock that no more work tomorrow. We're on strike. Well, the result was that these copper smelters or the furnaces just froze, and some of them were never operated again because it would have cost too much money to get them going again. I'm not familiar with the operations, but it was cheaper to build new mills instead of trying to operate and clear out the old ones. And Haywood tells him how there's a big smokestack just on the outskirts of Denver, Colorado, which is a monument to the tactics of the United Mine Workers, the Western Federation of Miners. That is never used again. Now, these strikes took place repeatedly, one after the other, up and down the mountain range, from Canada down to the Mexican border. And around 1905, the idea started to develop among the leadership of the Western Federation of Miners that they couldn't stand alone. They couldn't carry on this great heroic struggle by themselves against such tremendous odds. And the only thing to do was to organize an industrial union set up throughout the whole country. And in 1894 at their convention, the Western Federation of Miners passed a resolution calling for the Western Federation of Miners to take the initiative in setting up some kind of an industrial union set up in the United States. 1905, under the urging of this resolution, in Chicago met the leading radicals and trade unionists in the United States. They included Bill Haywood from the Western Federation of Miners, Father Haggerty from the Western Federation of Miners and the Socialist Party, Eugene V. Debs from the Socialist Party, Daniel DeLeon, the leader of the Socialist Labor Party, Simons, who afterwards wrote the famous History of the American Labor Movement, the most authoritative history, afterwards the founder of the International Socialist Review, which was a publication of the left wing in the Socialist Party prior to the First World War. There was about 25 of them. A man named Trotman, who was the secretary treasurer of the Brewery Workers Union, and openly about socialists. You can imagine someone in the American labor movement today whispering to somebody, hey, you know, I believe a little bit in socialism. These men were socialists, openly avowed. They were leaders of their unions. They were respected and looked up to. Well, they sat down and they laid the plans to found an organization called the Industrial Workers of the World, And after they signed a manifesto calling on the workers of the United States to elect delegates from their union to this conference to be held in Chicago 3 or 4 months later. This conference was held, and the Industrial Workers of the World was launched. The preamble of this, of the Industrial Workers of the World, laid down the fact that we're living in a capitalist society, that all the working class has is its working power to sell, and that the capitalists are reaping the harvest from their labor power through exploitation, that everything is owned by the tiny minority, that the vast majority create the wealth and is siphoned into the hands of the few, and so forth and so on. And it's the task of the working class to overthrow their masters and create a new society. That, in brief, was the preamble and purpose of the Industrial Workers of the World. Now, hardly had this been founded when Bill Haywood, a man named Pettibone, who was a great outstanding leader of the Western Federation of Miners, and Ray Dunn was telling me that Pettibone was a super expert. I think it was Pettibone. Or Orchard, Harry Orchard, was a super expert on the knowledge and the making of explosives. Knew everything from inside out, how to make explosives that could explode tomorrow morning or 10 years from now, the size and everything else, and so forth and so on. Well, these men were indicted for the murder of the governor of Idaho, a man named Starberg, I think, Starenberg. He was a noble creature who came out of the mines, a man of talent, came out of the mines, went into politics, picked up by the mine owners, and put in the governor's chair. And after he had become a success in life, he broke a strike of his former comrades of the Western Federation of Miners. Shortly after this, one fine day when he opened the gate to go into his house, a bomb exploded and he went to heaven. And Haywood and Pettibone and Moyer, who were all down in Denver, Colorado at this time, were indicted for the murder. They were kidnapped and brought up to Idaho, kidnapped on a train, kidnapped. You know, you talk these terms today and you come with probably saying, well, you can get an injunction against those kind of things. No, not in those days. They were kidnapped on a private train and brought up to Idaho, where they stood trial. And this was the great action of the working class of 1906. Right here in Boston, 40,000 workers in Boston, not New York City, not in Moscow, or London, or Paris, but right here in Boston, 40,000 workers protested, attended a protest meeting against the trial of Bill Haywood, Pettibone, and Moyer, who was president of the mines, Western Federation of Miners. All the energy of the Western Federation of Miners and the newly founded Industrial Workers of the World was thrown into the defense of these men. The Socialist Party pitched in a little. But to make a long story short, they were found not guilty. After being confined in jail for something like 14 months, Haywood was tried first, and he was found not guilty, and then afterwards the government decided, well, this thing is too corny, I guess we better drop the whole thing. Now, the leadership of the Western of the IWW, the president, was a man named Sherman. Sherman was a leader in the American Labor Union, this organization that had been set up by the Western Federation of Miners to fight the American Federation of Labor in the West. Never got to first base. But nevertheless, Sherman was one of their leaders, and he was elected president of the IWW. Vincent St. John wasn't present at the founding convention because he was in prison. But he was present at the second convention when Bill Haywood was in prison awaiting trial in Idaho. And I guess St. John was a head charge man, as we call it. You know, an individual that just has it, and he looked up to it and he takes over the work. And he took over the works in the second convention, the IWW, of the Wobblers, whatever we wish to call it. And jointly, He, with Daniel De Leon, drove Sherman out of the leadership of the IWW on the charge that Sherman was using too much money and spending too much money and accomplishing nothing. It's easy to see how a man like St. John could come to such a conclusion, because he never thought of money. Organizing, you don't need money. You just go out and you organize, period. That's all. You live off the land, and that's how the IWW developed. Living off the land and feeding off the capitalists, and organizing unions and working men and women all over the country through agitation, propaganda, and so forth. Well, they drove Sherman out. Comes 1908, the third convention of the AFL, of the International, the Industrial Workers of the World. And by this time, St. John had pretty well developed his philosophy on what we call political life. That is, he had arrived more or less at the conclusions of syndicalism. That is, that politics is just a lot of nonsense. You elect somebody to office, the best guy in the world, the best socialist in the world, and in 6 months he becomes a faker. So what's the use of wasting a lot of time running up and down this city, this state, this country, electing Joe Palooka to be president? Because he's going to betray you after all. And the only thing he can do is to organize and overthrow the whole system. Forget this finagling around with counting ballots and all that nonsense. And that was St. John's conception of politics. Now, in the founding convention of the IWW, Daniel De Leon, the leader of the Socialist Labor Party, had inserted a clause in the preamble that was quite vague, that the workers need political action alongside a trade union action in order to emancipate themselves. Well, St. John didn't like that. He didn't go much with his politics. So he decided to have a showdown with De Leon at this convention. Now, St. John was just like Bill Haywood, no education, no formal education. He wasn't much of a man for the books, as Jim Cannon says, but he had it. And when it came to this convention, St. John got rid of De Leon very easily by having the credentials committee refuse to recognize his credentials. Daniel De Leon was a member of the Bookkeepers Union or something, of the Socialist Labor Party. The bookkeepers or some darn thing like that, office workers, paper union that De Leon had set up, the Socialist Trade and Labor Alliance or something of that nature. Well, when he came to the convention of the IWW, the Credentials Committee said, "Now wait, look at that. Say, aren't you an editor of the paper, the Weekly People? Or the Daily People, whatever the Socialist Labor Party published in those days?" De Leon said, yeah, that's fine. Oh, well, look at this. See, your credential says that you belong to the paperwork, the Bookkeepers Union or so on. You belong to the wrong union. You can't be a delegate here. That's the way St. John threw him out of the IWW, the shortcut method. No big harangue and so forth. But they did allow De Leon to appeal to the convention. And St. John debated them, and the convention upheld St. John and refused to recognize the credential of De Leon, with a whole general attack against any politics in the IWW, which meant the end of Daniel De Leon and the Socialist Labor Party fooling around in the IWW. Now, the road has been cleared now. St. John is the undisputed leader of the IWW. Bill Haywood belonged to the Socialist Party and believed in political action. At the same time, he belonged to the Industrial Workers of the World, which was a trade union. We got to understand that this was founded as a trade union, not as a political party. As Jim Cannon says, actually, in actual life, it was half political, half trade union. But it was founded as a trade union which was to organize all the workers in the United States, of the world, not the United States, of the world, in their respective trades or occupations, culminating in the fact that when everybody was organized, the industrial workers of the world would say, well, Mr. Capitalist, look at you, better scram, because we don't need you anymore. Well, it sounded nice. And that's what the IWW operated from 1907 on. Now, by this time, they carried on an intense struggle inside the Western Federation of Miners for the radicalization of the entire membership. They carried on, particularly under St. John's leadership, carried on unrelenting struggle against the capitalists. At the same time, a depression broke out in the United States around 1907, and this crippled the Western Federation of Miners. It gave the opportunity for the Catholic Church to get in its licks. And Bill Haywood says that unquestionably the Catholic Church, the Irish Catholics in the Western Federation of Miners, played a most reactionary role in overthrowing the IWW leadership throughout the setup of the Western Federation of Miners. That's only one instance of where the Irish Catholics have played an outrageous and most reactionary role in American political and trade union life. With the expulsion of numerous IWW quitting the Western Federation of Miners, came a struggle against the Western Federation of Miners led by St. John. And that's too much to go into. Well, the IWW, we might say in brief, never got to first base in the East. Why? Because they were divorced from the industrial workers of the East. When they issued their manifesto calling for the workers to rally to the banner of the IWW, numerous individuals throughout the United States, from Boston to San Francisco, rallied to the IWW. Individuals, 10 in this union, 5 in another union, and so forth and so on. But not enough to create any kind of an organization on a mass base. And the result was that it lingered and hung in the air for years in the eastern cities, never getting a solid base among the masses. However, they did inject themselves, or were called into great strikes, strike situations that developed in the East from 1908 to 1915. Notably, the great strike down here in Lawrence, where the IWW organized the textile workers, 100%. In Passaic, New Jersey, where they organized the silk workers, 100%, under the leadership of Bill Haywood. Both strikes. Not only did they organize in the East here, in these two great strikes, but they also had the numerous strikes up and down the country. In the rubber, in Akron, Ohio, where Comrade Cannon was a participant. On the iron range in Minnesota, and in Duluth, Minnesota. In the copper range, particularly in Montana, around Butte, where they had undisputed control of the miners of the Western Federation of Labor, where they were recognized as the chief driving force in the mine workers' union. Now, that didn't mean that they folded up, by no means. The Socialist Party, as we have described before, was a horrible caricature of do-gooders, viciously anti-labor do-gooders, who for some strange reason thought they were socialists. And they completely repelled the vast majority of working class rebels. At the same time, these working class rebels realized that the IWW was all wet as far as turning their back on political life. But nevertheless, there was no place for them to go home to. So these rebel workers joined the IWW. Notably among them was our comrade Don Hill, that spoke here only a couple of nights ago, Jim Cannon, and so on up and down the line. Arnie Swarbrick, who is now out in Los Angeles. All of these men joined the IWW because there was no other place for revolutionary workers to join. And as Vincent Dunn says, he never accepted the theories of syndicalism, but there was no other place for him to go. While they were repelled from the East, because there was no opening for them, and because of the backwardness of the Eastern industrial workers, the IWW plunged into the organization of the lumber camps and of the sailors' craft on the sea sailing out of the West Coast. So that over a period of years, they completely organized the lumber camps. And they didn't do it through negotiation or arbitration or anything of that sort. They did it through the shortcut method. St. John openly advocated sabotage. He was a syndicalist. And part of the philosophy of syndicalism is sabotage. And the Wobblies boasted about their acts of sabotage. A very good book written by a Yugoslav who is now dead, called Dynamite, describes his experiences with the IWW. As a young man, he came to this country, contracted tuberculosis, and his doctor recommended that he go out west and work in the open. He might be able to recover his health. Well, one fine day he's working, and he hears this fellow behind him, an Irishman, say, take it easy, boy, take it easy. So, the old-timer said to him, hey, for Christ's sake, we're not out trying to build room in a day. So, after he got acquainted, he found out that a lot of these guys who walking, they wanted higher, more money. And after they get it organized enough, they let the boss know that starting Monday, we want so much a day. No, nothing doing. You're not going to get it. So Adamic tells of how when lunchtime came, they all took their shovel and went up and cut off a part of the bottom of the shovel, you know, the part that digs with. You want to pay us $4? We'll give you $4 worth of work. That's all. Another one he held over on a ship. This particular ship had a reputation of having pretty bad officers. And the ship used to ply between Argentina and Germany. The ship loaded up with all kinds of beef and so forth for Germany. Then it made a return voyage to Argentina with something, I don't know. But when the ship got into Bremen or Hamburg, Germany, lo and behold, they discovered that somebody, through some kind of a mistake, had switched the refrigeration pipes over to the furnace. And all the meat was spoiled. So, a story told by Joe Hill, the famous songwriter of the IWW, of how he was working in the wheat fire harvest. And they had all kinds of codes. These men had all kinds of codes among themselves, marks on trees and on freight trains and so forth, so that they could tell if this guy, you get a job with this guy, he's a son of a so-and-so. He'll work you to death. So Joe Hill was telling how he was working on this harvest for this guy that was no good. And he said somehow or other his pitchforks got caught in the machinery and ruined the whole goddamn harvesting machine. He said he couldn't understand how it happened, but it happened.